I'm Judy Swallow in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Thou shalt not lie, steal, kill, cheat on your wife, or lust after the one next door, and first and foremost, honor no other god before me. Those and the rest of the Ten Commandments are head-to-head with the First Amendment in Alabama. State Chief Justice Roy Moore had the Ten Edicts from Mount Sinai inscribed on a 2.5-ton granite slab and installed in the courthouse rotunda. That was 2 years ago. The ACLU, Americans United for Separation of Church and State, et al., sued. A federal appeals court ruled the state must remove the monument by next Wednesday. Judge Moore said no.
What's going to happen is that every mention of God will eventually be stricken from your public life. In God We Trust will be taken off our money. Under God would be taken off our pledge. When we cannot acknowledge who this God is, it will be taken from us.
Jefferson had his line in the sand, a wall of separation, he called it, between religion and the state. JFK was forced to pledge his allegiance to the Jeffersonian ideal to allay fears of a Catholic president. But America was founded by pilgrims who were fleeing persecution, but then tried to impose their religious views on others. The First Amendment says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Connection listeners, does that mean religion should have no place in public life? Do you have a problem with the Ten Commandments in a public school or a court of law? And when it comes to the separation of church and state, where do you draw the line? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALKS. My guests this hour have a range of views on these questions. Let's start with Rick Scarborough. He's president and co-founder of Vision America, an evangelical Christian group based in Houston. He's in Montgomery, Alabama right now, helping to organize a rally this Saturday to support Judge Roy Moore and his effort to keep the Ten Commandments monument on display. Rick Scarborough, why is this issue so important for you?
Well, let me start first, Judy, by clarifying or at least challenging a myth that you just advanced. Jefferson did not draw a line in the sand with his statement, separation of church and state. That's, you know, that builds the foundation for the misunderstanding of this whole thing from the very beginning. So I would challenge that statement.
Well, he actually said it. What are you saying, that he didn't
well,
say it?
I know. I'm trying to correct how he said it. He wrote a letter, a private correspondence to the Danbury Baptist Association in Connecticut, simply letting them know that they need not fear that his colleagues would be creating a state-run church like they'd run from England to escape. And that one line in a private correspondence was extracted in 1947 by the Everson Court, advanced as precedent in 1961, and is now believed by most Americans to be a part of the Constitution, but it certainly is not.
But as you see it, Rick Scarborough, well, all he was guaranteeing there was not to establish a state religion, right?
Well, I think you read the First Amendment, it's so clear that a baby can understand it. It takes the confusion of some in our courts and people like the Reverend Barry Lynn, who oddly enough, most people don't realize, is an attorney who once worked for the ACLU. It takes a whole lot of effort to try to rewrite the whole background of our country so that people today are confused on this issue. The First Amendment guarantees that Congress will not impose religious views, nor will it restrict the advancing or the practicing of one's religion. Chief Justice Moore has got it exactly right. He has literally drawn a line in the sand as one of the highest elected officials in the state of Alabama, and I, for one, and a lot of other folk, are rallying on Saturday, this coming Saturday, to show support of his courageous stand.
Now, Rick, I'm sure that most people would agree that it is fine to have the Ten Commandments on the wall in your house, probably fine to have them, I don't know, maybe even in a park, but in a court of law, this is upholding the Constitution. Isn't this saying incrementally that Christianity is the state religion?
Is acknowledging the God that our founding fathers acknowledged, Judy. On the front of this, in fact, the most prominent thing you see on this Ten Commandments monument are the words of the Declaration speaking of nature's God. When our founding fathers penned the Declaration of Independence, they made it very clear that the motivation for creating what is in effect an act of rebellion against England, where most of them had been born or many of them had come to this new country from, they were taking the position that there was a higher moral law than any law that man could create, and that nature's God had revealed that law. And the Chief Justice has simply inscribed the words of the Ten Commandments, that same God's revelation of how we first should behave in our relationship to Him. The first four of the commandments speak of our duties to God, and then the following six speak of our duties to our fellow man. And I don't find that objectionable, neither do I think that most Americans find that objectionable.
Rick, do stay with us. I'd like to bring into the conversation Charles Haynes. He's a senior scholar at the Freedom Forum First Amendment Center and an authority on the history of church-state disputes in America. Charles Haynes, we're talking about this line in the sand between church and state. Rick made a very important point there. Right there in the Declaration of Independence, endowed by their creator. That's putting God at the heart of America from day one, isn't it?
I think the way God is put at the heart of America by Thomas Jefferson and Madison and others is to say that we in this country will commit ourselves to protect liberty of conscience for every human being. So ironically, by adhering to the principle that God gave us each this inalienable right of religious liberty, we also adhere to the practice of making sure that the government stays out of religion, doesn't impose it, doesn't denigrate it either. So I think it's a deep misunderstanding. Of course, we have roots in biblical tradition, in the Enlightenment. There are many roots. And of course, our framers understood God in various ways. Some, like Jefferson, were deists. Some were more traditional Christians. But the key here is to understand that the principle that our framers were struggling with and disagreed about, just as we do today, is the principle of religious liberty, and it requires two pillars to work. One is that we keep the government, no establishment, from imposing religion or denigrating religion. The government must remain neutral among religions and between religion and non-religion. And the second principle is we protect the right of the people to exercise their faith freely and openly without governmental interference.
Why?
The key in this issue, in this case, is does the Chief Justice of the state of Alabama, as the government, representing the government, have the right to impose religion? No, he does not.
But why?
Not under the First Amendment.
Why, can I clarify this? Why do you think this particular monument breaks down that wall of separation? Why is this different than having In God We Trust on the dollar bill? I mean, aren't the Ten Commandments a moral code that apply to all Christians and Jews? It's pretty comprehensive, and it's not that specific to a very narrow religion.
Well, as a religious person, let me say the first table of the Ten Commandments, of course, asks us to give our lives to God and God's law. And that, of course, is a religious commitment. The second table does deal with moral law, and I think that the legislatures have always addressed the second table in legislation. So I think the Ten Commandments certainly has been an influence and it shapes, but it is a religious document, and it should not be secularized or made a civil document by government. That is denigrating to the sacred scripture, and that's why we make sure in this country that government doesn't co-opt scripture for government's ends. Because today the Ten Commandments may be interpreted by the Chief Justice in one way as the government official. Tomorrow he might interpret it another way. The real issue here is a pattern of trying to impose a particular interpretation of scripture through the government. The pattern is
that
not
is
just
absurd.
It's
that
not
is
just
absurd.
It's just not well let me just finish. It's not just putting a Ten Commandments in the courthouse. It's do you encourage people as a judge to pray in your courtroom? Do you, in your rulings, say that your rulings have to be based on scripture and that the Bible is the ultimate authority and the Constitution must be subordinate to it? The pattern of understanding the law and how to interpret the law in Roy Moore's career is what's really caused this crisis and what's at issue. It's not just the Ten Commandments monument in the courthouse.
Rick, we can hear the steam coming out of your ears. What do you say to that?
Well, I would say, I mean, where do I begin? In the first place, we don't have in our country right now an effort or a movement to impose our religious views on the country. The movement in this country is to expunge God from the public place. That's a complete misrepresentation of what's taking place. ACLU lawyers right now are fanning across this country and literally striking every semblance of God that there is in the nation. In this case, unlike any case to ever come before the courts, and hopefully will be heard by the Supreme Court, is the crux of it is summed up by the presiding judge, who said in the proceedings, as well as in his final findings, that the real issue is, quote, can the state acknowledge God? 27 days after raising that issue as the specific issue of the case, the 11th Circuit Court, in their final ruling, said the state cannot acknowledge God. Now, this is an historical step in the wrong direction by this country. For the first time, a federal court has said that it is illegal for the state to acknowledge God.
Rick,
that's an expunging of God from the public place.
Rick, can I take up that point about denigrating God and religion, though? Because courthouses are places where disputes between man and man are settled by man's laws. To imply that you're invoking God's law here, isn't it implying that a judge is a handle of God?
Well, to the contrary, Judy, the only hope for freedom to prevail in this country is for there to be a higher source of law. If you go back to the civil rights movement, we had governors across the South standing on the front steps of universities and high schools saying, blacks cannot enter this school building and we will prevent it, and they hollered states' rights. It was the Supreme Court of America that stepped over those states' rights issues and said there's a higher moral law. And their higher moral law was God's law. They went right back to the precept of the Declaration of Independence that said that God had given unalienable rights to all created beings, and among those rights were the right of to pursue life, liberty, and happiness. Now the same courts are striking any reference to a higher moral law. If they had taken that position in the 1960s, we'd still have divided schools.
Well, it wasn't,
I think
the
issue isn't moral law, Judy, if I may say. I'm glad Rick raised the question of defying the court, because that's really my more immediate concern in this case. The Chief Justice of Alabama has indicated that he doesn't think that the First Amendment should apply to the state of Alabama, and he has not yet indicated whether he will actually comply with a federal court order. That does echo back to the civil rights days when we had judges and officials in the states saying, we are not going to comply with federal court orders. It doesn't apply to us. The state of Alabama in those days felt it had the right to enforce segregation. And today, Chief Justice thinks it has the right to interpret to establish religion, to promote religion if he wants to. It's not acknowledging religion. The monument in the courthouse, let me just say, is not an acknowledgement of God. And the Supreme Court has not struck down acknowledgements of God, and it probably won't in our patriotic songs and so forth. What's at stake here is a Chief Justice in the middle of the night putting a 5,000-pound-plus monument in the courthouse and saying, really, in effect, symbolically, this is who we are in the state of Alabama and in this courthouse. And I think that what the principle here of no establishment and religious liberty is to protect conscience of every citizen in Alabama, not just Christian citizens.
Connection listeners, we're talking about whether the Ten Commandments should be posted in public places. Now, here's the thing. A recent poll by our guest Charles Haynes' organization found that 62% of Americans said that's fine with them. We'll chat about that after the break. What do you think? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Judy Swallow. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection. We're talking about the First Amendment and the current debate in many American cities about displaying the Ten Commandments in public places. Still with us from our NPR studio in Washington is Charles Haynes, senior scholar at the Freedom Forum First Amendment Center. And I'd like to bring into the conversation Rousey Bobby Blockham Hassan. He's assistant imam of the Masjid Tahid and president of the Muslim American Society in Huntsville, Alabama. Rosie Hassan, how do you feel about Judge Moore and his insistence on keeping the Ten Commandments monument in the building?
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank NPR for this opportunity to respond to this issue. About 6 years ago, we wrote to Reverend Moore, based on a comment that he had made in Washington, D.C., to a news reporter who asked him if he would allow Muslims to pray in his courtroom. And he said no, because they do not believe in the God of the Bible upon which this country was founded. And I'm sorry.
Razi, I didn't actually want to get into a personal thing. I want to talk about this actual monument. I mean, do you have a problem with the Ten Commandments? Isn't it just a moral code? You know, why has it got everyone so excited, this one piece of granite outside a courthouse?
Well, as I was about to say, we have no issue with that at all. Let me put it this way. As far as the separation of church and state, Thomas Jefferson made that very clear, I think, and I guess it's a matter of interpretation of that. But I'm not exactly sure how you want me to respond. These are not personal issues, but I'm not sure how you want me to respond.
Well, I mean, why does it get you so upset? Do you see this Ten Commandments slab as an imposition of Christianity or Judeo-Christianity in Alabama?
Yes, again, as I was about to say, when he said that Muslims do not believe in the God of the Bible upon which the country was the founding fathers found the country, then we took issue with that, because we do believe in the one God that's talked about. And here in Huntsville, about 50 clergymen of all races had gotten together, and to challenge Reverend Moore on this, we wrote him, and he never responded. But we take issue with the fact that it apparently is a Christian movement, and he does not recognize that there are other people of different religions in America. And when he said he would not permit Muslims to pray in his courtroom, then of course we took issue with that. If anyone, any other American has the right to do that, we certainly feel that we also do too, whether we exercise that right or not.
Razi Hassan, thanks for joining us. Charles Haynes, can you just, if you like, put it into context where we are now? A number of Supreme Court decisions about prayer in school, about Pledge of Allegiance, and they won't rule on that. Where are we actually now with all these many, many, many court cases about the Ten Commandments?
Well, it's interesting. I think this current Supreme Court has been very generous to religion and public life. Just upheld vouchers as constitutional, for example, which many separationists are very upset about. So I think it's kind of ironic that this court is being attacked as in some way taking God out of public life. I think where we are now is there's a widespread understanding in the courts, and I think among many Americans, the First Amendment separates church from state, but not religion from public life. People are free to bring their religion into public life. And as the Imam just pointed out, that includes Muslim Americans, it includes atheist Americans, includes everyone, should be free. So the real issue is, how do we treat this protection when it comes to government? And we are struggling with that. Where do you draw the line? The president may refer to his belief and faith. That's perfectly fine. He's free to do so. But when the president of the United States would try to legislate or impose his faith on people through some action of the government, that's where, at least broadly, we would draw the line.
Well, what if the president was giving an address from the Oval Office and there was a very prominent religious symbol behind him? Would that be a problem?
It might be. I think the president, like the Chief Justice of Alabama, has to be cognizant that these symbols do say something to people about what your agenda is. Are you president, Chief Justice of all the people, or are you just representing a particular view? Is this an effort to really say, I want to return America, as the Chief Justice has explicitly said, to a Christian America, where we tolerate others to be here, but we are founded as a Christian nation, we should maintain that? Is the Ten Commandments sitting there symbolic of his effort? And the courts look at a pattern. They look at motivation as best they can, because they are interested to see whether this is really an attempt to do something broader than simply put a monument up. After all, a court in the Third Circuit just this summer upheld a Ten Commandments plaque in a government building in Pennsylvania because it had been there 80 years. It was historic. It was just part of the architecture. And the court didn't see this as some attempt to establish religion. So I don't think it's always going to be in the courts that every time you see something religious, the courts are going to strike it down. I think what we need to do in this country is realize that we are trying to protect the conscience and the liberty of every citizen by making sure the government doesn't get involved in somehow imposing a particular religion or in somehow telling us how we should pray in a courtroom or what we should believe or how we should interpret the law. The law should be interpreted according to our Constitution, according to the laws of the land. And that's where I think Judge Moore has gone wrong.
Well, let me bring in now Michael Novak, who's Director of Social and Political Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, which is a conservative think tank in Washington. He writes for the National Review and a number of other publications. Mr. Novak, one of the things you've said in one of your recent publications is Chief Justice Moore has rendered a brave and invaluable service to our entire nation. What do you mean by that?
Well, it says in the Virginia Declaration of Rights that we must, as a nation, as a state in Virginia, recur constantly to fundamental principles. And Judge Moore is doing just that. He's reminding the people of Alabama, which is his charge, that the law of Alabama is rooted in God, as the first article. I don't have it at my fingertips, but it's on the monument. The monument, by the way, is inside the courthouse. It's 4 feet high and 3 feet square, 3 feet on each side. And its sides are filled with inscriptions from the law of the United States and the law of Alabama, and then some statements from great individual Americans, historic figures on this question. But what is that fundamental law? Well, if you read the Virginia Declaration of Rights very carefully and read Madison's Remonstrance very carefully, you will see that in the United States we get our idea of religious liberty from a particular source. The idea only works with a particular conception of God and a particular conception of conscience. It is a God who demands to be worshipped in spirit and in truth and in the light of conscience, and only in the light of conscience. Doesn't matter about bowing your knee or whatever else before him. It's what's in your heart that he reads.
What about the judgment when it was decided that this monument should come down? I don't have the exact judgment in front of me, but it says basically if you allow this to happen, you could also have Buddha in a courtroom or Jewish symbols or Muslim symbols.
Well,
would that be a problem?
I don't think so. I think here what you want to do is go back to the principles on which this nation was established and where we got our notion of conscience. Religious liberty is not a universal practice among the peoples of the world. The non-establishment and the free exercise is not universal. They were a distinctive original contribution of the United States. And it's very important to understand the principle on which they were founded. You don't have to accept that principle. It's in the nature of this particular principle that it wishes to respect those who disagree with it in conscience. That's the beauty of this principle.
Well,
that's explicit in the founding.
Let's bring in some calls, get some other views. 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Yeah, Michael, I'd like you to talk to the callers, actually, because we've got Francis in Raleigh, North Carolina. Francis, what would you like to say to our guests?
Yes, good morning. And Ms. Sparrow, welcome to our shores. You guys have already missed the battle. When I went to get married, I went down and got my marriage license at the courthouse. Then we went to the church, and I got married, said the vows. The preacher said, well, come on over and sign the book. Well, I was on my way to my wedding night, and I didn't have time for a bunch of paperwork. And he said, hold on there, sonny. You will sign the book, or I'll go to jail. Well, it turns out that the ministers, in order to perform that religious ceremony, have to have a permit by the state, and if they don't, it's a misdemeanor. That's $1,000 in hand or a year in the can. Secondly, when you fill out your tax returns, and I'm not exact on the number, but it's either 154 or somewhere around that, the Internal Revenue Service, Department of the Treasury, officially certifies and recognizes a series of religions as tax exempt. And if that isn't a conflict of church and state, tell me again what is.
So, Francis, actually you're saying there is no separation, because whatever you do in public life, like getting married or dying, you are you're embroiled in religion straight away.
Well, I'm just saying that the government has imposed itself in these matters where constitutionally they have no right. I mean, you know, let's not sign the book. Let them jerk the preacher up before a petty court and fine him $1,000. That way we'll get something on the books. And furthermore, I mean, I'm all for the judge putting the Ten Commandments down there. There isn't a country in this world whose laws, regardless of what they are, except for the godless communists who are on their way out, didn't start out with some sort of a religious precept to tell them and establish right from wrong.
Well, Charles Haynes, how do you respond to a couple of points there? But specifically, you know, church and state are so interconnected, you cannot separate
them. Well,
the
entanglement of church and state has been the leading cause of coercion and repression throughout human history. And in the United States, we've embarked on a remarkable experiment, as Michael Novak points out, to try to do something different, to arrange ourselves so that people with deep religious differences can live together without violence and without killing one another. That requires, first and foremost, ensuring government remains neutral among religions and between religion and non-religion. The caller is right to point out that we're not consistent, and certainly today, as opposed to when the First Amendment was written, government is involved in every aspect of our lives, and so that causes us to, I think, be more vigilant today about encroachments on our liberty by giving government the power to promote religion or to denigrate religion. Let me give you one anecdote, I think, in our state of Virginia, where I am, where I live, which illustrates the problem. Chesterfield County, they begin their county supervisor meetings with prayer. And they have a list of people who are officially approved to pray for Chesterfield County. And on that list, of course, are the folks that they consider to be respectable religions. They've allowed that Muslims can now get on the list, so they've been rather generous, but they only allow people that they think worship the God that they understand in Chesterfield County is the true God. This is the danger. Well, Wiccan wanted to come, and she said, well, I want to be on the list because we have Wiccans in Chesterfield County. She was told, no, you can't. So if you worship more than one God, a nature God or something like that, I think even Jefferson's understanding of God would not get on Chesterfield County's list, because it was not an Orthodox Christian or Jewish view of God. It was a deist view. My point in telling that story is to remind the American people that this is a very deeply important principle, to make sure that government does not have a list of official prayers, that government doesn't decide whose scriptures are going to be posted or built into our courtrooms. Government is to protect our right to practice our faith without
interference. But the reason that is so, Charles, is that we have a particular notion of what prayers are, which is that they must be from the heart and from the conscience, and that God accepts only those sorts of prayers. That's the principle that Jefferson and Madison appealed to, in any case, in writing their Declaration of Religious Liberty. And that's the thing that must be kept in mind. This is not a document about the state, this amendment. This is a document about religious liberty. What it says about the state is one thing only, that the national government, the Congress, shall not establish a religion. There were, in the colonies, 5 or 6 established churches in the different colonies. And the First Amendment was written in a way not to abolish those.
That's right.
Shall make no law respecting an establishment.
And
so
of course,
this is,
Michael,
primarily about religious liberty.
Well, Michael, I agree with you. And of course, the framers disagreed about the meaning of establishment. Some wanted to end those state establishments with the First Amendment and failed. And that didn't happen, of course, until the 20th century through the 14th Amendment that now applies the First Amendment to the state of Alabama. So that's true. You know more about this history than anyone, I think, and that's, you're right. But what I'm trying to suggest here is that the Chesterfield County should not decide what prayers are genuine or authentic. And I don't think Jefferson, Madison, in their wildest dreams, imagine that if they disestablished in Virginia, that one day officials in Virginia would be able to say, here are the prayers that are appropriate and approved. Would they say that we believe that there are such things as genuine prayers? Yes, they would. But they wouldn't want the government to have a list of who's on, who's off.
Let me bring in Chinaka now from Louisville, Kentucky. Chinaka, I gather you're from Nigeria.
Yes, I am.
Tell me why you think that's relevant to this discussion.
Well, I've been working with some high school students and middle school students since I've been here in the United States. I found out that they really don't have the fear of God in them, and they tend to do what they feel that to them it is good. If you now separate prayer and some instructions, especially concerning American heritage and the forefathers of America, who established this country through the Bible and through the principles in the Bible, you find out that when you separate them from that, you are raising a generation that will do things out of what they feel is good.
You think that the law cannot fill in the gap. There has to be a moral code, and that moral code has to be religion.
Yeah, the law cannot fill in the gap because they don't care. Sometimes they know the consequences already, and they still want to do it. But the religion plays a role in the way we think, our conscience. It kind of gives us a conscience that is alive, so that what we do, we consider people and people around us before we just go in boldly and do it. But my question,
my question for you, Chinaka, is coming from Nigeria. Why is in your view Christianity the moral code that should underpin life in America? I mean, where you come from, there's a strong argument that it should be Sharia law, Islam, which is underpinning the moral code, and Christianity is where it's all gone wrong.
Okay. Well, you see, I am not really against Sharia law because it plays its role in the Muslim part of the country. Now, what Sharia law does to Nigeria is that it helps to prevent crime religiously, you know, but it is not that it stops it, but it creates in the minds of people that there are consequences even after life.
Chinaka, yes. We'll come to this point after the break. Chinaka in Louisville, Kentucky, thanks. So what do you think? Religion in public life, no problem. Church creeping into the state, big problem. 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Judy Swallow. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection. We're talking about the First Amendment and the debate about the Ten Commandments in public places. My guests, Charles Haynes, senior scholar at the Freedom Forum First Amendment Center, and Michael Novak of the American Enterprise Institute. Michael, just before the break, our caller there was talking about Sharia versus Christian law. I don't want to get into Sharia, but isn't there a danger that if you get religion creeping into public life, you start talking about religion as the law, and then you've got a theocracy?
No, I don't think so in the least. I think you do have that problem in Sharia. That's what it is. But I think that in a country like this, you won't have anything like that.
But aren't you saying Christianity is superior?
Just hold on one second. Unlike Britain, we do not have an establishment of religion, but we have always had a strong accommodation between religious practice and the state itself. George Washington in 1789 issued a proclamation of fast and thanksgiving to Almighty God in thanks for what he had done for the country and in asking his favor on the future of the country. In 1861, answering a request from both houses of Congress, President Lincoln recommended a day of public humiliation, prayer, and fasting to be observed by the people of the United States with religious solemnities. And let me read one sentence from the proclamation in which he urges all denominations and all heads of families to observe and keep that day according to their several creeds and modes of worship in all humility and with all religious solemnity. And it goes on, asking for God's blessings upon our country. This is the President of the United States at the request of a joint motion of both houses of Congress. I think it is a mistake. Separation of church and state was an anti-Catholic slogan that grew up at the end of the 19th century. I think Charles is quite right that this country has always encouraged a strong presence of religion in public life because we recognize that the spring of our understanding of liberty and the necessary respect for the conscience of everyone, of atheists, of Muslims, of Buddhists, of everyone, is founded in those religious beliefs. That's very precious inheritance.
800-423-8255 to join the conversation. John in Ann Arbor, Michigan wants to. John, I think you've got a point for Michael, haven't you?
Yes, hello, thank you. This is John in Ann Arbor, Michigan. It's amazing to me that Thomas Jefferson was so far ahead of his time if in 1802 and 1803 he was using a phrase that allegedly didn't arise until the late 19th century as an anti-Catholic slogan.
Well, you can read Philip Hamburger's book on it, the law professor from the University of Chicago, Harvard University book. But, you know, he used the phrase, as someone mentioned, in a throwaway line, in a political letter.
Well, it was not a throwaway line,
that,
Michael.
That letter, which Thomas Jefferson wrote to the Danbury Baptist, was screened by his attorney general. They worked on it long and hard,
and
it was not just a private letter. It was sent out to the public. It was an open letter.
It was for political purposes. It was to make a political point for his party in Massachusetts.
And actually, Roger...
Divide the Baptist against the opposite party.
If I can just jump in, Roger Williams was the first to use the phrase separation of church and state. And I guess I'm a Roger Williams guy, but back in the Rhode Island days, Williams argued that we have to have a wall or hedge of separation between what he called the garden of the church and the wilderness of the world, or we will have corruption of religion, as at this day, he said. And I think, so that's where the phrase first comes.
Let's bring back John. John, apart from correcting history, what's your point here?
Yeah, well, I'd like to make two points. First of all, what's being lost in this discussion is this. The first commandment says, thou shalt have no other gods before me. That is this Christian or Judeo-Christian God. That commandment violates the First Amendment. There's no way around it. And we as an American society have a choice. We can have the First Amendment or we can have the First Commandment. You can't have both. Now, Michael Novak, your conservative guest earlier, said that we should carefully read, he used the word carefully, James Madison's Remonstrance from Virginia. Well, here's a brief quote from paragraph 7 of James Madison's Remonstrance. James Madison, of course, wrote the First Amendment. Here's what he said. During almost 15 centuries has the legal establishment of Christianity been on trial. Notice how he's talking about Christianity, not religion in general. What have been its fruits? More or less in all places, pride and indolence in the clergy, ignorance and servility in the laity, and in both superstition, bigotry, and persecution. Those are the words with which our founding fathers prohibited the establishment of Christianity in particular and religion in general. And we ought not forget that. This nation was not founded on biblical precepts. It was founded by deists with deistic ideas, and they're closer to today's humanists or atheists than they are to the Roy Moores.
Michael Novak, let's pick up that point in particular, that there is this conflict here, unless you say that this is a Christian country and the Judeo-Christian God is superior and the one God that rules this country.
No, I don't see that at all. I don't see that at all. First of all, Madison was making a point about the disestablishment of religion in Virginia, but it was the disestablishment of the Anglican Church, the Church of England. And the case was brought to his attention by the stripping naked of a Baptist minister who was preaching on a farm not far from Madison's house by an Anglican posse because he was preaching without a license. And they whipped him. They gave him lashes in front of everybody. And Madison found this such an outrage that he sided with the Baptists against the establishment in Virginia. It was the Baptists in Virginia who led to the disestablishment of the Anglican Church, and for very good reason. But the idea of God that they put forth also commanded that they respect the consciences of others, including atheists. There was a move in the Virginia Declaration of Rights to make special mention of when it spoke of the divine author of our religion, to name him as Jesus Christ. And the assembly rejected that on the ground that No, they wanted to include Mohammedans and Buddhists and atheists as well. But it was nonetheless an understanding of God that derived from Jewish and Christian roots, not from Muslim or Buddhist or atheist roots. It was that understanding that led them to this perception about the importance of religious liberty. That's a crucial point.
Let's bring in Jacob from Sumter in South Carolina. Jacob, in favor of the monument in the courthouse or not?
Yes, I'm in favor.
In favor, why?
Well, I think that these are basically true principles, generic. They're not uniquely Christian. Most of religions would accept these principles.
Well,
the idea of a creator.
The first commandment is no other God before me. And that God is not Allah, and it's not Buddha.
Well, I don't think the Ten Commandments actually state what God is this. Most people believe in a God as the creator, and that is one who should be first in their life, above man.
Can I throw that to Charles?
I think what we're struggling with here is the difference between allowing Roy Moore, private citizen, and all of us to express our faith, to put the Ten Commandments in front of our churches, on our lawns, in our public parks, if we allow other things, versus giving the government the power to define who is God, who isn't God, what is real good prayer, what is bad prayer. This is the problem. And once we get down into that discussion, it really is endless and difficult for us to ever decide in this day and age what God or definition of God we want the government to hold. I don't mind our elected officials recommending people to pray and to fast and so forth. Jefferson didn't do it as president. Other presidents have done it. People disagree about that. What I do am concerned about is giving the government the power to impose religion. The United States today is the most religiously diverse nation in the world. And would we in Dearborn, Michigan, want the judges to put the Quran as a monument in the courthouses? Would we in Utah want the Book of Mormon erected?
But the principle, here's the thing. We're relying on Charles. Just a minute. You've had a lot of time.
Can I address this?
The principle, if I may, just one second. The principle that we're relying on here is the recurring to fundamental principles. That's the principle that Judge Moore is relying on. In any case, that's the principle that ought to be relied on. We need to go back to the debate about what our religious liberties are founded in. They are not founded in those other traditions. They may yet be. There may be a way to make Islamic thinking come up with a doctrine of religious liberty that applies outside of Islam, too. I don't see it in print anywhere yet.
Jacob, do you say hear, hear to that?
Yeah, I have a comment to make on that.
Yeah?
Well, I am a Christian, and in fact, I am a Mormon. I've spent some time in Utah with my college studies. And I don't see a problem with hanging writings from the Quran if they are accepted by Christians as well and Buddhists and whoever else, just as I would not find it a problem to post writings from the Book of Mormon if they were generally accepted as true principles, not, you know, getting into one religion or another. And I don't think that by posting these things, the government is establishing law. They're not forcing anybody to follow them. They're just saying these are good guiding principles. Why can't we have those good influences posted if we're not required to live by them by U.S. law?
Jacob, thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Charles. Charles, isn't that the case, that this is a very religious country, the United States? The majority voices are Christian and believe in this moral code.
Yes, and I think morality is important. I'm president of the Character Education Partnership and encourage that in our public schools. What I discourage, our earlier caller from Nigeria reminded us that public schools are actually a good case study for this. We don't want public schools that are religion-free zones where we keep religion out. We don't want public schools, though, that impose a particular religion either, Protestant prayers in the morning, which drove Catholics out of the schools. We want public schools like a public square in America where all people are protected to express their faith, but we keep the government out of it. We don't have teachers telling kids how to pray or what prayers are acceptable or not acceptable. I think if we keep that in mind, that's the principle we're struggling with in Alabama. That if we look at Roy Moore's career, we see that he does believe that biblical authority should be invoked in deciding court cases. He does believe that people should pray in his courtroom. Juries should pray when he was a circuit judge. That is a fundamental violation of liberty of conscience. I don't, you know, the thing about the Ten Commandments, I think we could argue whether that is a close call or not under the First Amendment. I don't think the pattern of his career, we can argue, is anything but an attempt to say, we need in this country to return to a Christian America and to, through government, make sure that that is what we carry out in our law.
Michael Novak, do you think that the courts are losing the plot, that they're losing the very basis of what made America great here, you know, In God We Trust, going right back to the Declaration of Independence, right there on the American dollar, there is something underlining this country?
This is not a Christian country. It is not founded to be a Christian country. It was founded to be a country open to all. But nonetheless, the principles on which that became possible, the intellectual principles on which that became possible, grew out of the Jewish and Christian tradition. And that's very worth preserving and honoring and debating. It's one of the merits of what Judge Moore has done, is that we are arguing about the fundamental principles. Where do we get our idea of religious liberty? It's not present all around the world. It's an extremely valuable resource for the rest of the world. The rest of the world needs it. And so we need to keep going back to it and arguing our way to it. I want to remind you that during the administration of President Jefferson, the largest church service in the United States was held in the U.S. Capitol building, where the Congress now meets. And the music was provided by order of President Jefferson himself by the Marine Band. He didn't find that a violation of separation of church and state. He believed that we needed the fundamental principles that we derive from Jewish and Christian tradition to understand what we're doing.
Final word, brief word, if you would, Charles. Don't you need this moral code? I mean, it's like democracy, you know. It's the only system you've got. There probably are better ones, but it's the only one we've got. Isn't it the same with the moral code?
Well, I think Michael Novak is right to remind us of the importance of remembering our roots and what fundamental principles are. And yes, we should debate that in the public square. My only concern in this whole question is not about morality. I think the state has to involve itself in questions of morality and legislation. It always has, always will. I think the real fundamental issue here is how do we best protect the rights of conscience of every human being? Charles. And that we do by upholding the First Amendment.
Charles Haynes, thanks for joining us. Thanks, too, to Michael Novak, Rick Scarborough, and Razzie Bobby Blockham-Hassan. Our senior producer today is Tara Murphy. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection.